Call the Commerce and Labor Committee meeting to order. Seems we don't quite have a quorum yet, but we'll proceed on with testimony on House File 2112.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I won't move 2112 until we do get a quorum, and what I anticipate happening, Mr. Chairman, is that we'll probably be able to get through this in just a few minutes, and as soon as we get a quorum, then I'll formally move the bill, and we'll move it off to the House floor. But House File 2112 is a resolution that, I'm sure everybody on the Commerce and Labor Committee knows, the federal government thinks they want to get into the insurance regulation business. And we saw how well it's gone with the banking business. AIG is a terrific example of when we let the feds regulate folks like that. And at the state level, as the commissioner will attest, we've not had the same issues that the feds have had, because we have a good relationship with the folks we regulate. They've done a good job of regulating the bad actors, working well with the good actors. And we don't think it's a good idea for the feds to get into the business of regulating insurance when we do a pretty darn good job ourselves. With that, I will turn it over to our testifier, Commissioner Wilson from the Department of Commerce.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Atkins, and members. I appreciate the opportunity this morning, and there's little that's been more important to our department in the past 6 years than this bill. One of the things, as the chairman mentioned, the fact that the government has done such a lousy job in the financial area altogether, it's surprising to me that they would want to bring this up at this time particularly. Everything we do in the Commerce Department is related in some way to consumer protection. That fact is not lost, and I've been as part of the bureaucracy in Washington. I know that they don't have a consumer division. They don't have telephone numbers. They don't have websites, and they don't answer consumers. So that we think that from a consumer perspective standpoint, the fact that our department deals with the consumer perspective every day is important. Three main points that I'd really like to make this morning, and I'll start with one that was already mentioned. AIG is often pointed out as an insurance company, but AIG was really a holding company, and as most of you know, AIG Holding failed enormously. In fact, the OTS was regulating and had been with a large staff in there for 2 years prior to their failure, and they did not know within 30 days that there was a problem at AIG. So the 71 insurance companies that were part of AIG are strong, continue today to be strong, and are not part of the problem. On the other hand, Travelers, a local based company here, puts a different perspective on it. They represent a lot of large companies in this issue, and when recently the government had to find buyers for a lot of these large assets, they came to Travelers and others, mostly because they had the money, but secondly, they had a strong portfolio, and lastly, they know how to evaluate a marketplace and assess its overall value and do decent underwriting on products, which obviously the bank and Wall Street failed to do miserably. We appreciate very much over the past number of years that I've been working as the commissioner, the support that we've had from this committee. It's important, I think, when I came into the job, to recognize that some of the issues from a regulatory standpoint needed to have focus. Too many audits, too many multi-state exams, licensing was not unified. So this committee and the Senate committee has been very supportive in getting the Interstate Compact passed so that 35 states now can pass within a month a new filing, common licensing, electronic systems, the SURF system, which allows electronic filing. A good number of issues have been addressed by this state to accommodate some of the needs of the industry. I think without giving up any consumer regulatory responsibility. That's point one. Point two, the fact that that the insurance companies provide a lot of income to the state. And while the federal government would say that they don't intend to remove any of the income, I believe that that's only a temporary issue. And I'd like to make sure that the committee and others recognize that The fines to agents is $1.4 million a year. To the companies, about $800,000, and that's a low number this past year. To the agency, $700,000. Licensing for insurance agents is $7.3 million. And then the premium tax revenue to the state is $346 million. That's about $350 million worth of revenue to the state that's generated by our regulatory environment, which keeps the full force of the state in this regulatory regime. The last item that I wanted to mention is the fact that the regulation overall in our state, the consumer contacts are over 20,000, so that there's no effort on the federal level to make those kinds of contacts. And when there's a tornado or a flood or whatever, within 4 hours to 20 hours, we have staff people with uniforms identified on site going door to door to make sure that they have a copy of their policy. We make the contacts with the adjusters if need be. We follow up at town meetings. And I could go on and on. We can't afford, in my opinion, to give up the state regulatory regime. Less money at the state level, but with budget deficits and no consumer protection, is not the way I think we ought to go. In closing, Mr. Chairman and committee members, I fully support the language of the resolution and think that it would be a great help to the Minnesota if the Minnesota legislature passed this resolution and gave the department the support that I would need to also work with our congressional delegation and others. Thank you very much for this opportunity.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representative David, the questions of the testifier.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and a couple questions here. First of all, Representative Atkins, Chairman Atkins, I think you have a great resolution here. To think that we would give our insurance regulation over to the federal government is just bizarre to me, and so I think we need to be very, very clear. A couple questions to the author of the bill. First of all, Chairman Atkins, can I get on this bill?
All aboard.
Okay.
Hey, Representative David.
Same thing.
We had to get it in rather rapidly, so I'd love to get as many co-authors as we can. Thank you.
Sure. Question number two to the Commissioner. Commissioner, does this impact in any way the issue of equity indexed annuities? Do you refer anywhere? I don't see it here. Do you refer anywhere to the SEC takeover of equity indexed annuities, which are actually fixed annuities because the insured is not at risk at any point? Does this affect that?
Only in a very broad sense that it would continue to state that we do have the regulatory authority. There is some discussion about the loss of that in it to the SEC trying to claim that that it's insurance, but I think that we're ahead of that.
Okay. Mr. Chairman,
Representative David,
and to the Commissioner, I mean, you know, giving over, for example, equity index annuities to the SEC, the same SEC that brought Bernie Madoff and AIG, I think is quite frightening to me.
Are there any other questions from members? No. We still do not have a quorum, so we will wait to take action on this until we have a quorum. Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Members, we were going to take up, and my apologies to Commissioner Campion, Representative Chair Kahn has recessed her committee until 10:30, and so we've, out of deference for her and her committee, we've decided to take that bill next. So, Representative Kahn, if you'll come up, that is House File 631. It's for informational purposes only. It's regarding sportsbook gambling, and Representative Town, if you want to proceed, and then I believe that we've got Mr. McCormick from Health Research, who will give us a bit of an overview about the issue and where it stands federally. Representative Town, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's always a pleasure to be here. I just want to say a few things about this issue, which I've and I'll first say that I don't think House File 631 is in perfect shape, ready to be passed as it is, so I'm glad we're just having an informational hearing. But this is what my interest in this occurs because of all the illegal activities that exist in the world. I will put a bet, probably illegal if I put money on it, that everybody sitting in this room knows somebody who participates, either themselves or knows somebody who participates in this illegal activity, which is sports bookmaking. I have lots and lots of paper on this, but I decided guys are all computer literate, just Google sports betting and you'll get everything you want, including all the internet sites that you can get to and so forth. I'll get, let me just read one from one of them, which is an estimated $2.3 billion is wagered every year in legal state-regulated Nevada sports books, about 30% on college events. Law enforcement officials believe that $380 billion is bet illegally on professional and sports events. And so we're looking at some huge, and, you know, I also believe, maybe somewhat naively, that if something were legal, people would rather do the legal thing than the illegal thing. So the, again, another U.S. News and World Report, the legal gambling industry took in $2.5 billion in 1996, but illegal wages were estimated to account for more than $90 billion. So let me, the one thing that I did distribute to you, the one piece of paper that I did distribute to you, is the Attorney General's report. The one place that we went was that in 94, I guess, or sometime before that, we had legislation that asked the Attorney General to look at bringing a case to say that the federal law, which says that no states except the existing states could participate in sports bookmaking, was unconstitutional. And so we got this report, that which you all have copies of now, gives you a lot of information, including the federal law and so forth. I just want to point out two parts of it to you. The language that was put in the laws of Minnesota for 94, which is, I guess we don't have numbered pages, but it's kind of near the beginning, it's the Attorney General to consider action, where we urge the Attorney General to consider bringing an action to say that we don't have equal rights in the state. And I think now that we've had all this, you know, things like Bush versus Gore, which talks about the importance of equal treatment, that's now a stronger argument at this time. On page 13, if you look at the conclusion from the Attorney General, from the Attorney General's report, and 1 to 13 is possibly all that you would need to read, is that on page 13, it says that a law essentially says that a lawsuit by the state challenging the equal protection is highly unlikely to succeed in view of the United States Supreme Court precedent, because the state doesn't have standing to claim that the act violates the Fifth Amendment. So, and you also couldn't use the Tenth Amendment. What you would have to do to sum up that conclusion is the state would have to do it, and someone would have to move to stop us before we would have standing to proceed. So my suggestion, and that's probably why 631 could be much simpler than it is that the state would have to proceed. And I would say this is, again, a chunk of money that's out there. Had estimates there. I don't have a recent fiscal estimate, but easily $3 billion, I think, is one of the number of activity within the state that would be available for us to tax, regulate, and somehow achieve. And so that's all I have to say about it. I know the chairman has been discussing this with Mr. McCormick, and we'd probably like to see what someone who knows more about this than me has to say about it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Kahn. And we did, in fact, ask Mr. McCormick to look into it. He's, I think, prepared to give us a little bit of an overview of what we might be getting ourselves in for if we were to adopt something that said sportsbook gambling was allowed in Minnesota. Mr. McCormick?
Mr. Chair, members, Representative Kahn has the same number that I do that sports betting in America is a $380 billion illegal industry. That number comes from the National Gaming Impact Study Commission. I'm here to give you a little bit of background on the regulatory structure of sports betting in the United States. The Professional and Amateur Sports Protection Act, Chief Author Bill Bradley, was passed in 1992. This law prohibits gambling on sports in the United States. The current law states, it is unlawful for a government entity to sponsor, operate, advertise, promote, license, or authorize by law or compact a lottery, sweepstakes, or other betting, gambling, or wagering scheme based directly or indirectly on one or more competitive games in which amateur or professional athletes participate, or on one or more performances of such athletes in such games. This is from the Bradley Act. The Bradley Act grandfathered or allowed gambling in four states that had forms of sports betting on the books. Those four states are Montana, Nevada, Oregon, and Delaware. Of the four, gambling is active in Nevada. Delaware is currently considering a new law to legalize sports betting, and I think it has passed one of the two bodies in the Delaware legislature and is pending action in the other body. New Jersey was originally given a window to legalize sports betting, and they failed to do so. Montana allows some very limited sports betting, NCAA pools registered with their state lottery, that kind of thing. Oregon had a sports lottery, and it ended in 2007. There are two schools of thought about the Bradley Act. Those in favor of the Bradley Act would say that the Bradley Act has saved sports in America, allowing sports to be more or less clean, more or less divorced from the influence of gambling and money. There are two constitutional provisions that would be cited by a person who believes that this act is constitutional. First, the Constitution gives Congress the right to regulate interstate commerce, and sports is, in its view, interstate commerce. Even though the betting may happen within a given state, the games themselves are interstate. Often the wagering is interstate. And the second theory under which a proponent of the Bradley Act would state that things are constitutional is that Congress has the power to regulate the use of trademarks and team names, and therefore has the power to regulate how these are used in gambling activities. And so if Congress says you can't use the Minnesota Vikings logo in a as a trademark matter, that might be considered to be a allowable stance by Congress. Proponents have also noted that the NCAA has taken an active, and professional sports leagues to some extent as well, an active role in attempting to prevent running through threatening lawsuits and sanctions. Finally, there have been prior legal attempts at the district court level in state statutes to try to legalize sports betting. None of those have yet achieved the state of achieving a landmark ruling by the Supreme Court, so it would be fair to say that the Supreme Court has not validated the Bradley Law in any way. An opponent would claim that the act itself is unconstitutional. There is a current challenge underway in New Jersey. It's before the Federal District Court. There are efforts to consider legalization in several states. A legal scholar would note that the Supreme Court and the various courts' appeals has of yet never adjudicated the underlying constitutionality of the law. The New Jersey case cites a long list of reasons the act may be unconstitutional. One is a claim under the Fifth Amendment. There is a substantive due process clause in the Fifth Amendment. The gist of this argument is that the sports betting is allowed by some states and organizations and prohibited by others, thereby creating an unfair standard between the states. A second commonly cited reason why the sports betting rhetoric may be unconstitutional is the Tenth Amendment. This is the reservation clause that powers that are not specifically given to the government are reserved to the states. This argues that states have the right to regulate gambling within their borders. There are several other arguments cited in the New Jersey case, but these are the top two that are cited in almost every case. It's fair to say that the New Jersey case will probably proceed far enough so that the Attorney General of the United States will be submitting briefs on behalf of the government in that case. Government lawyers have been sort of silent when responded, but you may see a government response. That will give us a better argument of the nature of that case. If a New Jersey case goes forward, we may have a district court ruling in New Jersey, which will give us some idea of whether this could be legal. If, on a policy matter level, if sports betting were made to be legal, there are a number of estimates of how much revenue it could bring in. In New Jersey, the estimate is $100 million a year based on a normal level of taxation for sports betting. And that would be the New Jersey tax share of New Jersey betting, which would be done at the Atlantic City Casino. Oregon made $2.7 million a year, but that was only on a sports-themed lottery game. So they did not go whole hog. They just had a simple game that you could play that had a sports theme. One last comment is that the con approach uses the state lottery as the operating regulator and operator of sports betting. And that in part, I think, is because the Minnesota Constitution weighs in on what is constitutional and not constitutional for betting, and authorizing sports betting through the state lottery is an attempt to use the current state lottery exemption from the constitutional ban on gambling and to extend that. It's important to note that if, for example, I always say this, you know, people often don't listen, but it's true. If we legalize sports betting or we legalize slots and bars through the lottery, there would be probably a court case immediately, which would argue that allowing these games through the venue of the state lottery is an overly broad stretching of the constitutional exemption by which the lottery is permitted to gamble. And similarly to when we had a case to try to allow off-track betting parlors through the constitutional prohibition or permission for racetracks at Canterbury Downs and at Running Aces. In that case, it was determined that was an overly broad interpretation of the constitutional permission on fair mutual betting. We can't have an off-track betting program. So, and so Con and I both would agree with this. There's a long constitutional row to hoe, and what's different this year is that the state of New Jersey may begin doing the first step for us.
Okay. Mr. Chairman.
Representative Con, and then actually before we take that, Mr. McCormick, do you have a sense of what the timing is on that case? By the time we come back, February, March next year for regular session, will it be resolved or will it still be underway?
I don't know if it will be resolved, but I think it will be underway. I know that there will be briefs filed in response to the initial filing sometime later this summer, and after that, your guess on federal court actions is as good as mine.
Representative Conner, then Representative
David. Just one brief comment, and then I hope you'll continue the discussion, but I do need to get back. Having lived in New Jersey just before we moved to Minnesota from New Jersey, I have every confidence that the state of New Jersey will do the right thing.
By the way,
whichever way you want to interpret that.
Representative Conner, is this already part of your omnibus bill on page 892 or something like that?
we
know your proclivities, so, but Representative David.
Mr. Chairman, just I'd like to explain to the committee that when Mr. McCormick speaks, I do listen.
Yeah, he's our version of E.F. Hutton, I guess. Thank you, Representative Conner. We appreciate your presentation of the bill. For folks that aren't familiar with the process that we normally follow, with respect to both the next bill and this bill are for informational purposes, the goal being to try to get the committee up to speed on what the bill is about. My expectation is that over the course of the summer, we'll gather further information relative to it, particularly with regard to the New Jersey case, and we'll see where it ends up by the time it gets back here in the spring of, or by the time we get back here in the spring of next year. With that, we've got Commissioner Campion, who's going to give us an update with regard to, we previously had, for anybody that's following the agenda, we previously had a bill on by Representative Garofalo. He's opted not to have that bill heard, but we did want to get an update on the status of the department's efforts to pursue or enforce internet gambling laws. And Commissioner, I'll give you an opportunity if you have any kind of opening comments about it. Otherwise, we'll just go to questions from members of the committee. Representative Davis?
Mr. Chairman, not that I ever think about that I know how to run a commerce committee meeting, but did you call me to order?
No.
Okay.
You decided, well, depending on how it goes.
No, it's your bill.
I believe that we've actually hit 9 now. We need a quorum, so we'll, and commissioners, you can hold on for just one more minute. We've got the call meeting to order. We've got House File 2112, which was heard earlier. I will move House File 2112 be recommended passed and referred to the Committee on Rules and Legislative Administration. Are there questions or concerns about the bill? If not, I'll renew my motion that it be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Rules and Legislative Administration. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Is there any opposition? Say sign. Seeing none, that motion carries. And
Mr. Chairman?
And prevails. Yes, Representative David.
Minutes.
We have both, and Representative David moved the minutes to the last meeting. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
No.
Of course. That motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Davis.
With that,
Mr. Campion, thanks again for joining us. Can you give us a sense of where things stand today and what the department's objective was with regard to its recent action?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Michael Campion, for the record, is my name, the Commissioner of Public Safety. With me is Tim Leslie, Assistant Commissioner, who has the daily oversight over alcohol and gambling enforcement, the division within public safety that was responsible for the action in question. I don't really have a lot of prepared remarks, Mr. Chair and members. I'll see a couple things. I've been certainly we're here to answer any questions, but I think three things are important to keep in mind when you look at the action that we took here a week and a half or so ago. The first is the Department of Justice has stated very clearly for a number of years now that gambling on the internet is illegal. We have seen nothing to indicate anything other than that. Other states, particularly Michigan and Washington, in the last several years have actually taken legislative action to specifically outlaw internet gambling at the state level. A couple of other states, California and Nevada, are contemplating some other local legislative action in their states, but it's still clear that gambling on the internet is illegal. Second, alcohol and gambling enforcement was created by the legislature in 1989 for the specific purpose of being available to enforce all gambling laws. That is their charter, that is their legislative mandate, and in the wisdom of the legislature, alcohol and gambling was created as a state agency, not a local agency, but as a state agency to oversee the enforcement of gambling laws. Probably the prevailing question is, why did we do it when we did it? Or why did alcohol and gambling take the action here last week? Was there some specific reason for it? The answer to that is there was no specific reason for it. They took the action because it was routine and it was part of their normal duties. They have been dealing with and discussing with and contemplating action for some time over the last several years, of taking some position or some action on internet gaming. This was a very transparent civil process that went forward. There was no attempt to sting anybody or do something secretive. This was a real straightforward a process and notification to 11 companies that provide the vast majority of telephone and internet and services to people here in Minnesota. 200 sites were identified and they were notified that we felt that this was illegal and that we asked those companies to cease making gambling information available to citizens here in Minnesota.
Thank you, Commissioner. Let me make sure that I understand what you did, or what the department did. It contacted the 11 internet service providers that serve customers in Minnesota and asked them to block access to gambling sites. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
And did it provide them with a list of gambling sites to be blocked, or did it say just to block gambling sites generally?
Mr. Chair, for the convenience of those 11 companies, we identified some 200 sites. I suspect that there are probably hundreds beyond that. But for the sake of convenience and to get the process moving, 200 specific sites were identified.
Okay, and as I understand it, the basis that was used was the Common Carrier Act. I look for you to respond. Apparently the department and the poor person that was kind of the point guy on it have been sued by a group, or perhaps more than one group, saying that you didn't have a legitimate legal basis on which to pursue it. My question is that still the department's position? There's been, and a part of the reason for this meeting, Commissioner, was because we've heard all kinds of things, that the department's going to back off on this, the department's going to enforce it. But where are things at? Do you feel that you have a legitimate legal basis under the Common Carrier Act? And do you anticipate defending the lawsuit to the full extent of your abilities? Are you going to walk away from it? Can you just kind of give us a sense of where things are at?
Mr. Chair, we believe that we're on solid legal ground. There is certainly plenty of legal precedence for what we've done. We are very interested in trying to resolve this issue, dealing with the parties involved and having an open discussion with them. We're going to continue to try to do that. We'd like to get it resolved. We're not interested, I don't think, in some prolonged legal action. So we'll commence with discussion about people involved and see if we can't get a result.
And
further answer your question, I don't see any. And again, I want to underscore the fact that this was a civil process that we undertook. This isn't. We're not going to switch ponies, if you will, and now this summer embark on some real aggressive criminal process. And that's not our intent at all.
And we've actually got a couple of jockeys here in the crowd today, so
we like the word.
By the way, I should note, we appreciate the fact that as soon as you embarked upon this effort, you notified me. I don't know if all the members of the committee, but I'm sure you notified other members of the legislature and folks. And the reason our committee has an interest is because we have jurisdiction with respect to gambling issues. We also have Chairman Johnson of the telecom division has some jurisdiction with respect to those sorts of issues as well. So we wanted to make sure that as we are about to hopefully get done with session, that as we go into the summer, we get some kind of same page anyway as far as where folks are at. You talked of the possibility that, you don't want to be in litigation if you can avoid it. You think you're on firm legal ground. Have there been other possible ways of trying to get at the, I don't think anybody condones illegal gambling in the room here, but are there other ways that you've talked about trying to get after that issue?
Mr. Chair, well, I think we'll look at all options that might be available. But as you heard from the previous testimony with Representative Kahn, this gambling issue is a terribly complex issue. This is only one small part of what we're dealing with, what our action dealt with. And I would also kind of expand on the fact that legislatures around the country, as policymakers, very soon are going to have to deal with this whole concept of the internet and policing it and regulating it, the revenue that's shared, not only in gambling, but alcohol and prescription drugs and Craigslist and violence. There is just, it's an unregulated business. And part of our intent was, in an orderly manner, from a civil perspective, is to raise this issue and bring it to policymakers' attention. To highlight the fact that this needs to be discussed and decisions need to be made and at some point, and it's not a simple decision, but policymakers need to weigh in on this whole concept of what is available on the internet and how, if at all, we even regulate or police it. So that was part of our discussion. So, and again, any way that we can attempt to resolve this, yet bring this issue to policymakers' attention, that's what we'll try to do.
Right now,
again, in an orderly, not secretive fashion, if you will.
And we appreciate that. Right now, do you have the enforcement ability if you find out that Joe Smith is engaged in gambling over the internet on a poker site, for example, or some other site? Do you have the ability to go and knock down his door and assume it with appropriate warrants and all of those things, but and make an arrest of Joe Smith who's doing that, Mr. West?
Mr. Chair, members, Tim West, Assistant Commissioner. Our staffing is to the level we don't really go out aggressively and proactively do things like that currently. However, if something should come across that we need to investigate criminally, we sure would do that.
And the question was, you have that current authority. Is that right, Mr. Leslie?
That's correct.
The resources aside, you also, I think, one of the messages that you wanted to convey was that you currently have the ability to seize people's, if they have money in an online account, an illegal internet gambling account, that you have that ability to seize those funds. Is that correct? At least that was a message that was, I was just reading newspaper accounts, and it seemed like that was one of the things that was trying to be communicated.
Mr. Chair, members, I don't believe we were seizing anyone's account. I think the internet provider was shutting down the account, and then any money left in the account was left there. Some policy at the internet provider level said we don't refund any money less than $100, and some people had less than $100 in their account. So, unfortunately, that's an issue between the gambler, so to speak, and the internet provider. But we're not involved in taking people's money that's stuffed in there.
Okay. And I've got just one final question that I want to open it up to members of the committee or others. But what's been the extent of your conversations with the federal folks? My understanding, and Chairman Johnson's division have a better grasp of this, but that the feds do have regulatory authority with regard to the internet. We have some fringe ability to regulate certain things, but that we're preempted from doing some of the things, and I think the lawsuit suggests that we're preempted from doing exactly the sort of enforcement action that y'all are trying to do. But what's been the conversation with the federal authorities about trying to get after this issue?
Mr. Chair, at the same time the other letters went out to the 11 companies, a letter was drafted and sent to the Federal Communications Commission in Washington, D.C., notifying them of our position on it and our action and requesting a dialogue with them. We have not heard from them yet. It's been a few weeks. We anticipate that we will have some further contact with them. And you're right, they have ultimate regulatory authority over these providers.
And Commissioner, just to follow up on that, under what basis do you believe you have authority, or the state has authority to regulate the transaction? You're citing, is it under the Common Carrier Act or the Wire Act?
Yeah, under Section 1084, Mr. Chair, under Section 1084.
Okay. Are there questions from other members of the committee at this point? Representative Ellis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Commissioner, Mr. Leslie. From a national aspect, but also an international, I mean, I'd say probably a vast majority of these are outside our borders, our sea level, or our seaports. What has been kind of the international response to some of this? I have a sneaking suspicion these are in some countries that have barely any laws when it comes to their streets, let alone to the internet. And how has there been a kind of a coordinated effort across the I don't know if you call it the global internet community, but how are we going to get after some of these folks that are in countries that, you know, barely have street law, let alone the internet law?
Mr. Representative Zellers, the information that I have from 80 countries have sanctioned it, it is not illegal in those countries, and they regulate it in some form and or tax it. There's a few countries that don't take that approach. Again, it begs the entire question of the internet and what you do about it and how you regulate it and how you, I mean, part of our concern is protecting consumers. That's a smaller part, not a small part, but it certainly is a part of it. But I don't have an answer how you regulate all that. But again, this brings the question to policymakers that there is this world out there that, by some estimates, this internet gaming is a $60 billion industry. Not unlike the discussion you had with Representative Kahn, it's enormous amounts of money. So, I mean, how you regulate and trace it, I certainly don't have an answer for you.
Let me follow up on that. If this way doesn't work, either because the lawsuit's successful or it just proves to be too problematic, do you have other ways that you've contemplated?
I think Mr. Leslie might answer that question.
Well, I saw the two of you kind of look at each other. Mr. Leslie.
To be perfectly frank, we don't have a whole lot of tools in our toolbox beyond 1084, the statute that we're using right now. We have a 1960s toolbox for a 2009 issue. And so we're using our 1960s toolbox to try and bring attention to this matter, but I guess we're going to look to you to help us.
I knew it would end up after that. But are there other questions from members of the committee? Otherwise, gentlemen, thank you very much for the update. We appreciate it, and I assume we haven't seen the last of this issue. If you can just keep us in the loop as there are developments either on this particular front or other efforts. Are
we sure you will, Mr. Informant.
Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, Mr. Leslie. And then we've got Representative Mahoney's House File 2362, the Chairman's House File 2362, the recommended pass referred to the Committee on Rules and Legislative Administration. We first have, as I understand it, a division report, and I don't see Chairman Dabney, so the Chair will move that the division report be adopted. And members, this I think everybody's aware of this. This is just heard Representative Mahoney in the Division, Consumer and Labor Division at 8:30 this morning. This is one of those end of the week or end of the session kind of issues. My sense is that, and I appreciate the hearing that the division gave it, we are not, I don't believe, Representative Mahoney, correct me if I'm wrong, but the likelihood of this making it through the committee process is unlikely.
There's always hope, Mr.
There's always hope. I understand that, Representative Mahoney. My goal really was to get this bill heard by as many legislators as we can. There's always a possibility this time of year that bills become amendments on the House floor, and if this does become an amendment on the House floor, it would be better that some legislators actually heard the bill. We will then take, to the extent we can get testimony, we'll take some testimony, but we did hear from, I believe, 12 or 13 different folks in the division. Summary of the hour and a half of testimony will be shared with members as well. But Representative Mahoney, I want to get an opportunity to at least hear your bill, whether we're able to move it out of here or not, or lay it over, but I want to make sure that we've given you an opportunity to have it heard by as many legislators as possible. So Representative Mahoney, your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And before I say anything more, I want to correct some testimony that I gave in the previous committee where I said the department essentially wrote the bill. If you look at 2362, the department worked with staff on the language on the subdivision 2, not on subdivision 1. They had nothing to do with subdivision 1. That was primarily advocates, myself, and staff. So I want that to be very clear on the record. Mr. Chair, I have an amendment to this particular bill, and if I could do that before I get started.
Absolutely, Representative Mahoney. It's my understanding that it's an oral amendment. Ms. Newman was kind enough to actually draft it for us, and the Chair will move then that House File 2362 be amended as follows. On page 1, line 12, delete the words "or development agreement." Then on page 1, line 18, delete the words February 1, 2010, and insert December 15, 2009. First question, Representative Mahoney, did I get that correct?
You got that perfectly.
All right, the Chair will then move that. All in favor say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that puts the bill in the shape that the author desires to move it.
And I will explain what that amendment did.
Thank you, Representative Mahoney.
Line 1.12, where we took out "or development agreement." Development agreement pertains to new construction, and this bill is entirely concerned with maintenance and municipal codes, which would only apply to buildings already built. And on line 1.18, where we changed the February 1st to the December 15th date, My intent is to get a bill drafted and circulated long enough ahead of session next year that everyone will have a chance to read it and not feel surprised or left out of the discussion. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, please excuse my voice. This House File 2262 sets aside the Morris versus Sachs lawsuit, which essentially said that the only code in the state was the state building code, and voided municipal rental codes or municipal maintenance codes. That's subdivision one. Subdivision two asked the Department of Labor and Industry to pull together an advisory committee to review the municipal codes and report back to the legislature. One of the concerns that has come up with Morris versus Sachs, and there's a number of them. I'll start with the first. Building code enforcement employees are concerned that they do not have the ability to enforce any code other than the code that the building was built under. So, with the state building code not have been developed till 1972, someone like myself lives in a house that is built in 1912. I have the ability to put natural gas lighting into my house and can kind of thumb my nose at the city. Natural gas lighting is not a real safe thing. The other part to this is that there's questions whether they can require something like a GFI or a ground fault interrupter in a bathroom in rental properties now, or they can regulate the size of spindles so that young children don't get their head caught between them, whether they can require under the building code fire alarms. Under the fire code, they can. So we're starting to get overlap between state building codes and municipal codes and fire codes, and we need to have clarity. The witnesses against this will say that it's going to cause undue chaos. What this bill says is that what we've been doing for the last 35 years prior to Morris versus Sachs is still in effect for 1 year while the department comes up with some answers to what should and shouldn't be in a municipal statewide code. So that a landlord that has a piece of property in New Brighton has the same maintenance codes in Eden, or St. Paul, or Hallett, or Worthington. I don't think it's fair to those landlords that they have to be up to snuff on 200 different municipal codes. I'm trying to bring clarity as much as we possibly can in building codes. There's confusion by the cities. This does not allow for any code, any new code, to be developed by a city or a municipality. If you look on line 1.14, that code has to be in effect prior to May 15, 2008 in order for it to be continued. Chair and members, although all this bill is trying to do, well, I'll put it this way. I've been trying for the last 2 months to get agreement between the parties. They had 6 months prior to my getting involved in it. There has been no agreement. This bill will drag in the Department of Labor and Industry, an uninterested third party, to develop this particular code so that we can bring it back next session here it more fully in committee and make a decision if we can add some clarity to the law. That's what this bill does, and I would ask for your support, and I'll stand for questions.
Thank you, Representative Mahoney. And just kind of a housekeeping, we do go into session at 11 o'clock, so I don't expect members. I would like to at least get a little bit of testimony. I won't be offended. I'm sure no one will if members feel we need to head off to session. I believe we're just going to go to session and then and break for caucus. But just as members start to leave, I didn't want people to think we were being rude. It's just that we're in session in 4 minutes. I would like to take a little bit of testimony. Is there, do you have perhaps one chief proponent for the bill in support that can give us their perception and perhaps in a similarly situated person in opposition to it?
Mr. Chair, I think either Lisa Finetta or Jack Horner for the opposition, and I think either one of the cities of St. Paul would be just fine. One of each would be, okay. This testimony was heard pretty extensively an hour ago.
Yeah, I understand it had an hour and a half worth of testimony in the division. I'll leave it. Let's go with the, we've heard the bill and arguments in support of it. Is there one person that can kind of summarize the opposition to it in like 5 minutes? Mr. Horner, welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Jack Horner, representing the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association. Mr. Chairman, there's a number of organizations that are very concerned about this. I have a handout from the Minnesota Realtors. Thank you. And members, I think you have in your packets information that we have provided. I would just summarize items, and if there are questions or I'm not clear, obviously I'd be happy to respond to those. First of all, the first point is that the state building code provides an important safeguard for all property owners in Minnesota. It's the cap. It says that a city can enforce maintenance, of course, can enforce improvements to property, but you can't exceed the state building code. This bill specifically allows a city to adopt or to have adopt to enforce any kind of a code that exceeds the state building code, that goes beyond, is different in any way. This bill simply deems, as a matter of law, that the local ordinance is right and the state building code is not applicable. The state building code has served us well for decades. It's developed by experts based on national codes. It provides important, objective standards. Building officials all understand it. Anybody can turn to it. And yet, this bill would say that local ordinances anywhere in the state, large cities, small cities, whether the ordinances are clear or not, or developed 30 years ago, whether they've been updated like the building code is constantly, whether they were developed with any hearings or experts, whatever they are, and we don't know what they are, and you've not been presented with evidence what they are, but whatever they are, they supersede the state building code for 1 year. The building code clicks off, and these ordinances click on regarding maintenance and the housing. Secondly, this bill would overturn current appeals. You have information from a Star Tribune article a week ago in St. Paul, and there was extensive testimony. Ongoing and very serious controversy in St. Paul regarding enforcement of codes. Allegations that the city is violating the building code, others say not, but the point is that there are some 68 pending appeals to the state hearing officer. This bill would simply say your appeals are out of luck. We deem the ordinance to be correct, the state building code to be incorrect in this area. You have information that I won't go into, but also you have information about a landlord in Minneapolis who was ordered under criminal threat. I mean, these are criminal laws. Misdemeanor, 90 days or $1,000, he was ordered to do something that's absolutely against the law by state statute. If he had not been able to appeal, which he did, he would have had to spend thousands of dollars in closing stairwells in a building that simply is not necessary, that our state does not require, and that in fact would be violating the code, and yet it would be deemed that the ordinance was correct, the building code's wrong, the landlord would have spent thousands of dollars in unnecessary and wasted work. Moving on, Mr. Chairman, this provision affects all property owners in Minnesota. Whether you are trying to sell a home as a homeowner, and we've all seen in the papers articles about cities forcing homeowners to bring buildings all the way up to code, not just to safe levels, which they clearly can do and should do, but all the way up to the latest provisions of code, costing homeowners thousands of dollars before they can sell. You've seen rehab that is rendered economically unfeasible because local codes are requiring buildings to be brought up full to code, not to the rehab standards as are incorporated in the state building code. These are important topics that cost thousands, probably hundreds of thousands of dollars. If this bill goes into effect, and the building code clicks off for a year, all those properties who now think they're in compliance with the code, and in fact they are in compliance with the state building code, would not be. City ordinances could come and say, I don't care if you're in compliance with the state building code. Our ordinance goes beyond the state building code. Property owners would be required to do a great deal of work that a year later is again, once again, when the building code clicks back on, would be deemed to be unnecessary, not needed. The building code is very safe. This legislature and the state building code division would not be adopting legislation or rules or building code that didn't provide for perfect safety. Safety is not the issue. Maintenance is not the issue. Let me just close, Mr. Chairman, with probably the most important point, because there's been so much confusion about it. There's been a lot of statement, a lot of talk, that somehow the cities have to overturn this court case, Morris v. Sachs, in order to do proper maintenance. That is absolutely, simply, and categorically not true. There is no statute, no case, no rule, no building code provision that says that building officials cannot require that a property be properly maintained, that everything works. If the plumbing doesn't work, they can order it fixed. If the window's broken, they can order it fixed, no matter how old the building is. And it's simply not accurate. And when you ask city officials, well, where's your citation? They don't have any. They've got vague fears, unfounded fears, as it turns out. Morris v. Sachs, the case, treated this issue. The city of Morris tried to raise the issue. Well, we can't do maintenance. The Supreme Court said, not so. You've got plenty of authority to do maintenance. You have in your packets that I'm just kind of going through quickly here in this one that starts off with the Scrib article. The last page is a relevant page from Morris v. Sachs, from the decision from Morris v. Sachs. After testimony, after reviewing the law, after briefings, after full argument, they said, our decision should not be misconstrued as precluding all municipal regulation of rental housing. And then it went on to list all the laws that are still relevant, that are still active under the building code, safety laws that are required. It says that municipal housing regulations are not prohibited by the state building code, etc. They have to comply with the building code regulation. And the final sentence, this leaves many permissible areas of regulation. Morris v. Sachs essentially changed nothing. The court simply read the plain language of the building code, said, yep, that's what the legislature means, that's what they've always meant, and ruled accordingly. Kevin, this is a lot of harm in the click-on, click-off, and it's not at all needed for purposes of working further to see whatever further development may be needed. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I really appreciate your accommodation here.
Thank you, Mr. Horner. And there's Dick Lampert from the city of St. Paul that I think wanted to visit right on that. The nub of the issue is that issue of whether or not cities can continue with their maintenance codes. You had one perspective. Mr. Lampert sent me a note up here that apparently he believes, or the city believes, that there's some ambiguity with respect to it. So if we could certainly hear from him, that I think for the committee's sake would get us right down to the heart of the issue. Mr. Lampert.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dick Lippert, L-I-P-P-E-R-T.
Sorry.
That's okay. I'm the manager of inspections for the city of St. Paul. We make many, many inspections, tens of thousands up to nearly 100,000 inspections a year. Our purpose in doing that is to make the city a better place and to make it a safer place to live. I don't think what is being proposed here does is create some clarity and get rid of some of the confusion. This does not abandon the building code. It does not throw out the building code. It doesn't even deal with new construction. It deals with maintenance of rental property. It deals with maintenance of owner-occupied property. It does not deny people's right of appeal. People still have the right of appeal. What we have now is confusion. We've been enforcing our housing codes and our property maintenance codes. I personally have been doing it for 38 years. It's worked very well for us. It's created a great deal of safety in the city of St. Paul for homeowners and renters. More effects threw a wrench into that. And I think there is a great deal of confusion. we are willing to and eagerly look forward to the opportunity to meet with the Department of Labor and Industry and create some kind of consistency, something that will work in St. Paul, in Minneapolis, in Austin, in Chisholm. That's all we're looking for. We're looking for to stay pretty much the status quo until we can fix this. We're not looking to abandon anything. We're not looking to change the building code. We're not looking to for every city to create a new standard for building buildings. And I think that's about as brief as I need to be.
Thank you, Mr. Unless
you have questions.
Appreciate that. You all came up as a team. Does your partner there? I don't know if you're Batman or Robin.
I should have been Robin. This is Phil Owens, the assistant city fire marshal for the city of St. Paul. He manages the fire certificate of occupancy program, which is responsible for certifying and inspecting all rental property in the city of St. Paul.
All right. Thank you. Are there questions that members have? Because I do, it's a little unfair to keep members here when we're in session, but I just want to, are there any burning issues that people have or anybody else that they want to hear from? Yes, Representative Zellis.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Mahoney. You're a man of your word, and I'm assuming that this is meant as an introduction to the issue, because I would really hate to see something like this at this late a date become a floor amendment that may resurrect its head, which is within your purview on the House floor. But this is an issue that, based on the mail we've gotten, and some of the, I unfortunately wasn't able to attend. I was in your district most of the morning in a traffic jam. But from what I've heard from folks, this is a pretty contentious issue, and I'd hate to see it as a floor amendment.
Representative Mahoney, you want to respond to that? That's what we do, Representative Zellers. When we have a deadline, we offer things as floor amendments. Representative Mahoney?
I'm shocked that you might have had a traffic jam in my district. I don't have a freeway. But having said that, if that's what we do, my intent is to bring this as far as I can through the process. And if I get timing, we'll have a conversation about it on the House floor. I think this is important enough that our cities have confusion and can easily be drawn into a multi-$1,000 rewrite of the municipal code because of this. And I don't think our cities need to do that without a clearer direction of what they have jurisdiction over and what the state wants them to write their codes to. I want clarity, not just for the landlords, not just for the cities, but for the taxpayers, because we end up paying that kind of rent.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I do appreciate your honesty, Representative Mahoney, but this is one of those issues that, and I understand that you tried to bring folks together in a respectful way early on, but this is one of those issues that it was a week left in session. This is too big to bring up so late, and if you were still working on it, I appreciate that, but I can honestly say, yeah, and if it does come as an amendment, this is something that in reading some of the stories and talking with some of the folks, this is being used by some cities, maybe not those here, maybe not, documented, but as a money-making deal for requiring either a whole bunch of what may or may not be maintenance or improvements or who knows what. And, when we get folks trying to sell houses in an absolute abysmal market, to put them on, to leave them on the market for an extra year or 6 months or whatever it is, I think that's a very, very complex issue to deal with in 1 week left in session.
Yeah. Representative Mueller?
Well, Mr. Chair, I was going to ask Representative Mahoney after the last bill whether he still uses a 1960s toolbox, but seriously, I think... if this is going to come up on the floor, I think it's a really serious thing, and maybe, Mr. Chair, I don't know if you can find it, but to do this in 10 minutes or something is not... There's a lot of issues here, and I remember from legal practice St. Paul doing a lot of outrageous things, and yet I also see that if we don't go beyond the state one, I'm worried about what will happen to cities like St. Paul, Minneapolis. So I think there's maybe some place in between, but we're not going to find in 10 minutes the answers to these issues. And if it's going to come up on the floor, it'd be nice if we could have a really full hearing on these
Thank
issues.
You. Thank you, Representative Mullery, credit to Chairman Dabney. He did give it a very full hearing, and then some this morning, as I understand it. I see the list of the testifiers, Chairman Dabney, and I agree, Representative Mullery, that I don't think we're going to necessarily find the answer here today. I did want to at least give as many legislators the opportunity to hear about the issue. I know that there were some folks that were aware of it, but it was a limited number on the House floor. So I appreciate Representative Mahoney trying to move it through the process a little bit and give as many legislators an opportunity, particularly the division that is right on the top with respect to jurisdiction over it. In light of the fact that we are now in session and that we don't have our full complement, I'm going to leave the bill over with respect to this committee, but I do appreciate the opportunity to at least hear from both sides. We've got the division report and the opportunity to hear from Chairman Dabney and others about what the testimony was with respect to that. I would also invite all of you or any of you, if you have additional comments that you want to submit by email or in writing, to please do that. And the final comment I would make is, and I give Representative Mahoney a lot of credit, he has brought together some sides that I never thought could be brought together on other bills, and I would hope and expect that he will continue to try to do that with respect to this bill so that we don't have the issue that Representative Sellers raised about many, many members hearing it for the first time when it gets to the House floor and that whole issue of floor amendments. But I wish everybody the best of luck in trying to resolve it, and if not, I really do expect we may see it on the floor yet. So thank you all very much. With that, I believe we've done all of the business that we need to do. This is likely our last meeting of the Commerce and Labor Committee. Thank you to all members and all the staff for your efforts this year. And with that, we stand adjourned.